Good to see you all this evening, by the way. I got to come here. How many of you were here last time I spoke? A few of you? Okay. Got to speak a number of months back, and got invited back. So I'm assuming that that's good news. Either that or other people are like, no, I think the Dodgers are playing, so I'm going to stay home. But yeah, and game seven too, and you guys are here. So the faithful, the remnant, really, the called remnant. But I just want to say thank you so much for having me. Certainly, you know, for I think all of us, you know, struggling with what it means to be a parent in and of itself, that's a tough dynamic, right? And then on top of it, okay, if there are some mental health issues or whatever it may be. And then put on top of it that I'm experiencing parenthood. I'm experiencing some challenges with maybe mental health issues or whatever it may be. And then on top of that, I'm filtering other people's perspectives, right? My parents might be telling me what you need to do is, or I might have a friend who's like, oh, you got to try, or you got to read this book or whatever it may be, right? Then you come to a talk like this and you're saying, oh, the therapist was saying X, Y, Z or whatever it may be, right? And it's a lot to handle, you know, it's a lot that you're trying so hard to be what God's called you to be, and at the same time you're doing hard work of filtering and trying to understand all this, what am I seeing and what should I do about what I'm seeing, and on top of it, I've got a job and I've got relationships and all of this kind of stuff. So all to say, I really am blessed by people like yourselves who say, you know, I want to do this well. I want to do this better than I'm doing it. Or maybe just affirm that what I'm doing is working or whatever it may be. I appreciate that you guys are taking time out of your schedule to make this a priority. That's awesome. And one of my prayers is that God blesses you for that. God blesses you with direction. God blesses your kids. God blesses this church with healthy families and healthy children who bring Christ to that next generation, et cetera, et cetera. So thank you so much, you all, for showing up tonight. Again, my name is Jeremy Gordon, a marriage and family therapist, an associate marriage and family therapist, a local faith-based nonprofit called Journeys Counseling. I've got about six therapists there. I've been there for a little over 4 years. I've seen you know, a lot of individuals, a lot of couples, families, but part of what's gone on for me, for one reason or another, God's given me a lot of adolescents. There are plenty of therapists who don't like adolescents very much because it can be tricky ground. Honestly, it can be really tricky ground. But for me, I really enjoy it. I truly enjoy adolescence. I think part of my background is adolescence was a difficult season of life for me personally, confusing and just all kinds of stuff. So I think there's that resonates for me. But another is just being, you know, trying to be a good parent and helping other parents out. And then also just God provided it. Just ends up being lots of adolescents, males in particular, where parents are like, hey, I've got a male, I got a son, and I want them to see another man or whatever it may be. And you're kind of like a unicorn if you're a male therapist, because there just aren't a ton of us for sure. And then if you're a Christian male therapist, it's insane. So that's been just part of my dynamics. It's been pretty good. I got a graduate degree over at Cal State University, Dominguez Hills, and then I got my undergrad in Bible down in San Diego Christian College, which I grew up in San Diego originally. I've been a husband for 9 years, same wedding day and year,
yeah,
right, as the Flunties, so not the same wedding space, though. Should have worked it out, got a deal or something. And then I have two kids. I have a five-year-old daughter named Maya, and then I have almost three-year-old son named Will. They keep me busy for sure. But what we'll do is, so I'm going to jump into this and kind of give us like a thumbnail sketch. These are a handful of things that I hope we walk away with in general, and then we'll kind of unpack that, okay? I will say that, man, I am going to probably go at a pretty fast pace here. But we'll have question answers time at the end, so feel free to write down questions or whatever it may be. And I'm going to try hard to get as much of this in as possible. And then hopefully some of it you retain or whatever it may be. I'm going to be checking out the PowerPoint a lot because my notes got messed up and this isn't going to do too good for any of us. So I'm just going to be kind of peeking back here. It's not because you guys look weird or anything. It's just that makes more sense to me. But so I'll say this and then we'll kind of jump in a little bit deeper. But big picture, I'm going to try and break these up into two kind of main categories. There's like a biblical perspective about anxiety and depression, and then there's a clinical perspective, okay? And again, just really broad strokes, okay? There's so much to be said about these things, but just really broad strokes. I'll kind of break it down in these two big categories. I can't remember if we did this last time. Did you keep my PowerPoint last time and give it to people? Yeah? Okay. Okay, so we'll do that then. We'll do that again. So if you want to save yourself from taking copious notes, you can feel free to take the digital copy of the PowerPoint. But so two broad categories, the biblical perspective about anxiety and depression. The three things I'd love for us to walk away with are, first and foremost, we're all imperfect, okay? So as we talk about mental health issues, this isn't something outside of us, so to speak. In some sense, we're all in the same boat here, okay? And we'll unpack it more here in a little bit, but just as a quick thumbnail, we are all imperfect, and anxiety and depression are just two forms of the many forms of imperfection, okay? So I'll unpack that a little bit more, but that's one thing. We're all imperfect. Depression and anxiety are just two forms of imperfection, so to speak. Scary, I mean, as a parent, it's a scary form. It's a confusing form. It's a frustrating form. It's all kinds of stuff that gets elicited when we're interacting with depression and anxiety, but just one of many forms of imperfection. Number two, when we have an adolescent, or maybe we have someone in our family who has depression or anxiety, or both, it's an opportunity, okay? So it might feel like, it does feel like a negative situation for sure, but it's an opportunity for deep connection, for this deep intimacy and relationship, okay? Again, we'll jump into that a little bit more. And the last one is, it's an opportunity for me as a parent to grow, okay? And again, we'll dive more into this, but as I interact with my adolescent and we go through some trying times, potentially, there will be plenty of opportunities that God will use this mental health issue for my development as well, okay? Clinical perspective here. Again, from clinical perspective, like if I was reading, there's the DSM is the manual that clinicians read through. If I'm reading through the DSM in general, this is kind of what the DSM would have to say. So most clinicians would kind of conceptualize it this way, okay? Depression, anxiety, though they're certainly separate disorders, like you have anxiety disorders and you have depression disorders, though they're separate disorders, they are similar in the fact that they're imperfect reactions in the body, in my thoughts, in my emotions, in my relationships. DSM won't add in my spirit, but for us, and in my spirit or my spiritual journey, they're all imperfect reactions in those realms, which impede a healthy life, okay, or a balanced life, or whatever it may be, okay? Well, again, we'll dive more into this. And then the second one, it's important as a clinician for me to try to interact with these areas to try and bring health, if that makes sense. So the anxiety and depression live inside these different categories, and as a clinician, trying to interact with the body, trying to interact with the thoughts and the emotions, trying to interact with relationships, and again, as a believer, trying to interact with the spiritual dynamic, okay? Whew, we're saying a lot just in that little piece, but that's kind of where we're starting. So with that said, I'm going to pray again, and then we'll kind of jump into more specifics here. And God, I just I thank you so much. I really do ask that you would bless all of us here who have taken the time. God, we want to be holy as you are holy. We want to be righteous, God, and we acknowledge that we struggle with it. We're not perfect parents like you are to us. We are not that to our kids at times. And so we come here humbly and just ask that you would keep growing us. Each of us has some dynamic, something that you're sitting next to us saying, I really want you to get this. And I just ask that you would help us to be able to hear it. What is it you want us to hear tonight, Father? We want to open ourselves up to it. At the same time, God, you know I'm not perfect, so I'm going to say something that's imperfect or off, and I just ask that you would be helping everyone's spirit to be discerning. If there's something that needs to be filtered, something that needs to be thrown away, I just ask that would be able to be seen. We love you. We certainly need you. And also our adolescents need you, God. Thank you so much that you care for us, that you care for them. So in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So what's going on? So the biblical perspective, we'll kind of jump back into that. Just the first one of the biblical perspective, we're all imperfect. And basic what I'm saying is when sin came into the world, back in Adam and Eve, when sin came into the world, it impacted everything. Okay? It was like an atom bomb that just... And when I say it impacted everything, it impacted our bodies. Okay? So now we have things... Now we have things like cancer, right? Now we have things like thyroid disease. Now we have all these different dynamics within our bodies that was affected, that our bodies became something different, became muddled when sin came into the world. Same thing with our relationships with each other, our relationships with God. Sin impacted that. Sin impacted our thoughts, the way we think. Sin impacted the way we emote, the way we interact with our emotions. Sin impacted everything. So the bottom line is we're all imperfect, okay? And that's where depression and anxiety fit into, okay? So when I'm interacting with my adolescent who's anxious, who's depressed, it's not that there's something other than me. It's just they're exhibiting their imperfection in a certain way, whether it lives inside their body, whether it lives inside their thoughts, inside their heart, whatever it may be. That's their particular imperfection, right? But I have my imperfections, right? So in some sense, I can see, okay, we're both in the same boat here. You're not outside of me. I'm not outside of you. It's not an us and them type dynamic. We're both together. But this is your imperfection, so to speak. So how do I graciously interact with you in this space? Okay, kind of makes sense a little bit. I'll just say this real quick. One thing that resonates for me, and maybe this will resonate for you, is that even godly people struggle. Okay, even godly people struggle. So the idea of struggling with depression, struggling with anxiety, this isn't for people outside of God's will, so to speak, or this isn't for people who just aren't following God, they're out of faith, and then once they get realigned with faith, then they won't struggle anymore, okay? And the two examples I have are these two. One's an Old Testament one, and this is Elijah, the prophet Elijah, and this is in 1 Kings. Elijah, real quick, Elijah was a faithful prophet. He made some sacrifices to follow God, okay? At one point, he comes back to Israel in hopes that God's going to do this miracle and it's going to change the heart of the Israelites who have, at this point, they're two separate kingdoms and one part of the kingdom is pretty apostate, okay? They're worshiping idols. They're doing all kinds of stuff that's not what God wants them to do, okay? So Elijah comes back into the mix. God says, we're going to do a crazy miracle. And Elijah is really resting on the idea that finally the people are going to come back, essentially, okay? So here in 18, we see Elijah comes and they set up this little altar situation, right? And so all the prophets of Baal are going to pray to their god Baal, and the fire's going to rain down, take all of the offering away. So they're praying hard, and nothing happens, okay? Elijah says, let me get this. I'm going to try this, okay? He says, but first, dump a bunch of water on the offering. Okay, dump a little bit more. Okay, dump a little bit more. Now it's completely saturated. Absolutely no way this thing's going to go up in flames, right? God, do something amazing. This big, gigantic flame comes down. This, not only does the offering get consumed, but the entire entire structure, altar, gets consumed by fire, right? Some just amazing stuff, right? After that, Jezebel, who's the queen, the king's wife, says, hey, Elijah, I am going to kill you. So she had a really big stake in the prophets of Baal. Blah, blah, blah. I'm going to kill you. Well, Elijah's like, oh, man. He gets super scared and runs, leaves town. Okay, takes his servant with him. They run to the city, and then he tells the servant, just forget about it. You stay here, man. Save yourself. I'm out of here. He goes all farther off in the wilderness. All this to say, he sees God, or not sees God, but he talks with God, and he says something to the effect of, my paraphrase, God, I've had enough. Kill me. God, I've had enough. Kill me. Not, I've had enough. Let's get a replacement. I'm going to work on my golf game. God, I've had enough. Take me out of here. the suicidal, as a clinician, suicidal ideation. I don't want to be alive anymore. He has done amazing things with God. He's seen amazing miracles inside his relationship with God. And yet he is at this place where he's saying, God, enough. I can't handle it anymore. Even godly people struggle with their emotions, struggle with their thoughts. Okay. The second example, John 12:27. This is in the Holy Week. Okay. This is Jesus has just come into Jerusalem. There was the palm branches, Palm Sunday happened. People are just going wild. Jesus is in Jerusalem. He's doing all crazy stuff, cleansing the temple, all this crazy stuff. But Jesus knows something. Time's short. He's going to be killed very soon. He knows this. Okay, in his, not just in his mind, in his body, he knows I am going to be wiped out pretty soon here. Okay, so now here we are, like Monday or Tuesday, and some of his disciples are kind of hanging out, and some Greeks come up to the disciples and say, "Hey, can you get us to talk with Jesus? Can we get like a face to face with Jesus?" And the disciples are like, "We'll check." They go to Jesus and say, "Jesus, hey, these Greeks want to meet you. Is that cool?" And Jesus doesn't even answer the question. Doesn't even answer anything about the Greeks. What he says to the disciples is, "My time, my hour is here." And he says something so fascinating. And this isn't the day of his death. These are a few days before his death. He says, my soul is sorrowful. I'm in this deep, I'm trying to remember the exact, it's terasso is the Greek word, I believe, and it's this stirring of his soul, this distress, so to speak. And he's telling his disciples, my hour is here, and I'm deeply distressed. Okay, they're like, well, we were just asking about the Greeks, like, what's going on here, right? And he says, I'm going to die soon. And then all of a sudden you hear, this is the way I read it, so again, filter this if it's wrong. The way I read it, all of a sudden he starts talking to them, and he says, what should I say? God, take this away from me? But this is why I came in the first place. And it's almost like he's having this wrestling match out loud with his disciples. I'm so distressed. I would love to not do this. But wait, that's why I'm here. And then we see Thursday night, he's in Gethsemane and he's saying the same thing as he's praying, right? But even before he's praying, the way that Matthew, Mark, Luke all describe it is that he's distressed, he's grieved, he's very sorrowful, he's troubled. And then even as he's praying, God, please take away this cup, right? I don't want to do this, okay? And we see that even godly people like Christ struggle deeply with these thoughts and these anxieties, okay? That it's something when sin came in the world, we struggle, okay? And it's not for the ungodly only, it's for the godly as well, okay? Let me see here. Was that? Okay, now let's jump in clinical perspective, okay? Again, though depression and anxiety are different disorders, they're similar. Their imperfections, or they're imperfect in the way that we react with our body, with our thoughts, with our emotions, with our relationships, within our spirit. Now, again, from a clinical perspective, there are two overarching categories. Anxiety as an overarching category, but underneath anxiety there are anxieties, okay? And in depression there are depressions, okay? Depression, some of these types, you have major depressive disorder, persistent depressive disorder, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. There's disorders like that are kind of brought on by medical, disorders brought on by substance use, etc. Again, just types of depression. And then in anxiety, different types of anxiety. Social anxiety, you can have agoraphobia, different phobias, panic disorder, generalized anxiety, etc. Okay, we will not get into those, all of the different dynamics there. We're just going to talk broad strokes about depression as an overarching category and anxiety as an overarching category. Okay, and this is kind of the way that... I mentioned that DSM, this big thick book that talks about different disorders and whatnot. This is the way it defines depressions, excuse me, okay? It says, a common feature of all these disorders is the presence of sad, empty, or irritable mood accompanied by somatic, which means bodily, and cognitive, which means in the mind, the way you think, changes that significantly affect the individual's capacity to function. What differs among all of these different depressions are issues of duration, you know, kind of how long they last, timing, when are the onset of them, and then presumed etiology or the cause of these different depressions. Okay, so they all are kind of in a similar category, but then they kind of differ in the way duration, timing, etiology, etc. Okay. This is a pastor named John Mark Comer. He has a book called My Name is Hope, and he just talks about his struggle with anxiety and depression. And this is the way he kind of makes it a little more 3D or a little bit more tangible, the way that he describes it. But he says, depression is when sorrow becomes a way of life, not a phase. When joy, hope, and life are snuffed out of your soul. When you are sad for no reason at all. When no matter how hard you try, fight, and work, you can't pull yourself out of a bad mood. When you wake up sad, when the day grows worse with each passing hour, when pleasure is like ash in your mouth, when family and friends are distant, when you are tired all the time, when dreams and desires for the future die and all motivation and energy is gone, when life is really, really horrible. So an upbeat book. You should probably read that if you want a good time. No, it is a pretty good book. But, and then this is the way, again, DSM defines anxiety. It's going to be a 2-slider because it's pretty long here. But again, overarching category, but there are anxieties, disorders that share features of excessive fear and anxiety and related behavioral disturbances. Fear is the emotional response to, and catch, here's a good distinction here. Fear is the emotional response to real or perceived imminent, something that's about to happen, threat. Whereas anxiety is anticipation of future threat, okay? So it's one thing when I'm sitting in class in front of my history test, and all of a sudden I realize, oh, wait, I studied for math last night, not history, and now I feel fear in the moment, right? Anxiety is I'm studying for my math test at night, and I'm saying, oh man, this teacher's the worst. I'm never going to get a good grade. It's not imminent threat necessarily. It's before that. I'm predicting the future, and it's going to be a bad future in some sense. Okay. Anxiety is more often associated with muscle tension, vigilance, you're being very aware, in preparation for future danger, and cautious or avoidant behavior. Sometimes anxiety is reduced by pervasive avoidant behaviors or avoidance behaviors. Which means, hey, because I'm predicting there's going to be a bad thing in the future, I just won't go. Like, it's kind of like an agoraphobia. I'm just going to stay inside because everything that's out there is bad. It's going to be bad. I know it's going to be bad, so I'm just going to stay inside, right? Or social anxiety. I'm not going to go to that party because I'm going to say something stupid. Everyone's going to laugh at me. I'll just stay here, right? The anxiety disorders differ from one another. They're different in the types of objects or situations that induce anxiety, or the avoidance behavior and the associated cognitive ideation, the way you're thinking about these different things. Again, John Mark Comer in his book says, anxiety is when fear takes over your mind, when fear moves from tangible to hypothetical, when what-ifs of life suffocate your brain. You can't fall asleep at night, can't relax, when your mind won't turn off, imagination runs haywire with no boundaries or limits. Your chest is tight, your breathing shallow, and your head dizzy. When your lungs speed up to a frenetic pace and your heart screams through your skin. So it lives inside your body, right? It lives inside your mind, lives inside your emotions. For a lot of people, that's their experience. There are a lot of stats. You guys want some stats, or you want me to skip the stats? Stats, okay. Diagnosis of major depression have risen dramatically by 33% in general since 2013. But here's something interesting for us. The rate is rising even faster among millennials, 47%, and adolescents, 47%. We're going to talk a little bit about this. 47% for males or boys, 65% for girls. Okay, so it's rising fast in adolescents, but faster for girls than boys. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Okay. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, more than 18% of adults, and then right at the end, 25% of children from 13 to 18. So you see, again, more for adolescents, 13 to 18-year-olds, than it is for adults, right? Depression occurs more often in women than men, okay? So we're going to talk a little bit about this, okay? And there are a number of reasons for this, so, yeah, anyways. There some differences in the manner in which the depressed mood manifests has been found based on sex and on age. Right? In men, and this is going to be similar for those of you who have boys who have depression, but in men, it manifests often as tiredness, irritability, and anger. They may show more reckless behavior and abuse drugs and alcohol. They also tend to not recognize that they are depressed and fail to seek help. Okay? So there's a whole dynamic, social dynamic around depression and seeking, you know, if it's if it's weak to seek help or whatever it may be. But one distinction is that men tend to externalize. If they're feeling depressed, they externalize. They'll get in fights. They'll do substance abuse. They push it out of themselves and into the environment. Get it out of me, and I'm going to do stuff, reckless things out there kind of thing, okay? And what we're going to see is women internalize, okay? I feel depressed, and I keep it inside myself. In women, depression, and again, this is saying women like adults, but this is also adolescents, tend to manifest as sadness, again, internal worthlessness, and guilt. In younger children, depression is more likely to manifest as school refusal, anxiety when separated from parents, and worry about parents dying. Depressed teenagers tend to be irritable, sulky, and get into trouble in school. They also frequently have comorbid anxiety, eating disorders, or substance abuse, which means they'll feel depressed, but then they also have like an eating disorder. They feel depressed, but they also have an anxiety disorder. They feel depressed, but they also are having a substance abuse issue. It's not uncommon, and now this is one thing I really want to highlight here. It's not uncommon for someone with an anxiety disorder to also suffer from depression or vice versa. Nearly one half of those diagnosed with depression are also diagnosed with anxiety disorders, okay? So the reason why this is important is this next one. Depression, I mean, it's important because it already makes it a difficult dynamic if you're wrestling with two things at the same time. But here's another part of it. Depression exacerbated by anxiety has a much higher suicide rate than depression alone. In one study, 92% of depressed patients who had attempted suicide were also plagued by severe anxiety. Okay, so you think about depression or anxiety on a spectrum, you know, certain amounts of anxiety that you're feeling anxious, but you can cope with it in some sense. But then there's severe anxiety where you can't cope with it. You don't get out, you don't hang out with friends, you don't blah, blah, blah. So individuals who have depression, and then these individuals are here, 92% of them that attempted suicide, they had this severe sense of anxiety along with a depression. Okay, so these two things living side by side can make it a really difficult dynamic, especially with adolescents who are fumbling with skills and trying to understand their world, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. But here, I think this is helpful. So adolescence as a hotspot. So what we were saying, 18% of individuals struggle with depression, whereas 25% of adolescents, right? So it's a higher percentage for adolescents. Part of the dynamic is adolescents and young adults can be kind of, this stage of life can be a kind of a hotspot for mental health in general, okay? And there are a number of reasons for that, but in general, adolescents, what we can see is a lot of mental health issues end up cropping up at that stage of life, okay? Partially because it's a season of change, you know, you're moving from middle school to high school, you're being expected to do more, you're kind of freaked out about college expectations, you're kind of freaked out about, oh, if I get a job, and then in young adulthood, I do get a job, I do get go to college. I have all these changes happening inside myself, and those stressors, those environmental stressors, they overload you in some sense, and now provoke these reactions of anxiety or depression. Whereas when the environment wasn't that stressful, it wasn't pointed out that I had depression because I wasn't really lifting a heavy load. It's like almost like, you know, like if I have a bum shoulder, but if I never move my arm, I'm fine. But if I have to move my arm, it's like, oh, now I feel my bum shoulder. Well, kind of in adolescence, it can be that way. I have this huge change in life. I wasn't really having to move, and now that I'm in adolescence, I'm having to move, and now I'm seeing it's coming to the forefront. My anxiety, my depression is coming right out in the forefront, right? Yes, I'm having to make decisions. I'm having to be autonomous. I'm having to interact with my friends, etc., etc. Second part of it, too, is I didn't put it up here, but biology. Our brains are in constant development in adolescence. So from about 12 to 24, our brains are shifting and moving. And part of that dynamic is your body's getting rid of stuff you don't use anymore, okay? So you learned you learned about kaleidoscopes or something in kindergarten, and your body's like looking through all the files. What do we need? What do we need? Kaleidoscopes? We never used that one. Get rid of that one, right? There's a lot of stuff that is pruning out of your brain, and when it prunes it, stuff gets exposed. Okay, so maybe you have this genetic or biological predisposition, for anxiety or depression, but it was covered up by so much stuff. And now as the body kind of gets rid of the stuff you don't need anymore, well, now those genes and that dynamics is kind of exposed. Okay, so that those are part of the dynamics why adolescence is potentially a hot spot. Also, older adulthood, but we won't get into that. As a side note, you know, we talk about depression and panic attacks and stuff colloquially. We'll say, oh, man, I'm... You know, adolescents, and we even do this as adults, you know, like, oh, man, the Dodgers lost. I'm so depressed, right? And we're not saying I'm clinically depressed. We're just saying I'm sad, I'm bummed, or whatever it may be, right? Well, same thing with panic attacks. So I just want to throw this in. Jason and I were talking about this, and I thought this would be a wise idea, too. Throw this in. You might hear some people say, oh, man, you know, my daughter, my son was really freaked out. Was that a panic attack? Or maybe your son or daughter or their friends will say, oh man, I was at school and we had a pop quiz and I had this panic attack. And I just thought this would be helpful to know what a clinical panic attack is. I don't think you necessarily need to tell your student, well, you know, hey, clinically, that's not really a panic attack. But just for your own knowledge, what am I dealing with here? Is if this is a panic attack, if I know some of these symptoms and I interact with my adolescent, I can kind of suss out, oh, it was a real panic attack, and now maybe I'll go to a professional to kind of unpack it. Well, if I talk with them more and find out, oh, it wasn't a real panic attack, well, then we can kind of talk in a different way, okay? So the essential feature of a panic attack, again, clinically, a panic attack, is an abrupt surge of intense fear or intense discomfort that reaches a peak within minutes. Okay, so it's a pretty quick thing. Within minutes, and during which time, four or more of the physical and cognitive symptoms occur. Okay, so you have this real brief experience, and it's intense. Okay, and here are some of the things that you're going to feel: palpitations in your heart, pounding heart, accelerated heart rate, sweating, trembling or shaking, sensations of shortness of breath or smothering, feeling of choking, chest pain or discomfort. Abdominal distress, feeling dizzy, unsettled, unsteadied, lightheaded, faint, derealization, which is a feeling of unreality, like this isn't real, or depersonalization, a feeling of detached from yourself, like you're not in your body, you're kind of outside your body. And then these last two are cognitive: fear of losing control or going crazy. I don't have control of this. My heart's racing. I don't have control of this. I'm sweating and I can't control this. Or you're going crazy. I feel crazy. Or fear of dying. And then the interesting part about as we interact with panic attacks with people that we love, these last two will exacerbate the problem. Okay. So if I'm feeling this sense of I can't breathe because I'm feeling freaked out about something. Oh man, I can't control this. All of a sudden, the feeling of I can't breathe becomes even worse because I sense maybe I'm dying. Well, I don't want to die, and now it's getting even worse. It's got to stop. It has to stop now. And what ends up is really just a couple minutes feels like a lifetime, and then you're scared to death to ever feel that again. I don't ever want to feel that again, so I have to do anything I can to avoid whatever was in that situation so I never do it again, instead of being able to kind of step back and be like, okay, it was just a couple minutes. Next time I feel that, here's how I can interact with it, right? So as a parent, if I have a child who's experiencing a panic attack, part of the dynamic is kind of empathizing with them. Oh man, this is scary. Like, Dad, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. My heart's racing or whatever it may be. Be like, okay, I'm sorry, sweetheart. Yeah, oh, this is scary. And talking with them, Dad, I think I'm going to die. Oh, I hear you, sweetheart. I know, it's scary. You're not going to die. You're safe. I'm here. I'm here with you. You're not going to die though, okay? It's going to go away in just a minute. And you can kind of empathize with them and help try and take off that second level of that's going to exacerbate and make it even worse. We don't need to diminish it. Come on, you're not dying. You're going to be fine. It's going to be over in a couple minutes. But we can't empathize with it. Whew, this is scary stuff. And at the same time, we don't need to add this extra level. That kind of makes sense. It was a lot. Just a little quick side note. Kind of makes sense a little bit. And feel free to ask me questions as we go farther. Okay, yeah, we'll jump in. We're going to go get to kind of our response. But here's a kind of a question that I think can be a little confusing for us. You know, because part of depression, part of anxiety seems to be describing normal adolescence, right? What is it? You're talking about moodiness and irritability? That's called being a teenager, right? So what are we talking about here? So wait, all teenagers are clinically depressed? All teenagers are clinically anxious or whatever it may be, right? Just as a rule of thumb, not that now from here on out now you can be therapists or whatever it may be, but a rule of thumb is as you're interacting with your child, trying to assess out, wait, is my adolescent just being an adolescent or is my adolescent struggling with something maybe more clinical? The first question is this atypical for my adolescent, right? Do I have, say, in general, a pretty upbeat adolescent, but then all of a sudden they just go into this nosedive where they're just really depressed, withdrawn, sad, teary, irritable, and man, that seems to be happening. I've noticed that they pivot between these two things significantly. They're normally this way a lot of the time, but then all of a sudden they pivot this way. If it's abnormal behavior, potentially there's some clinical stuff going on here. And then the second one, which supports this, how long are these symptoms? My adolescent is really moody, really irritable, and it's lasting for a few days. Well, that's not necessarily clinical necessarily. That's a bummer for sure. And how do we interact with this? You know, for a few days. But if it starts pushing into multiple weeks. Okay, now we have something that's probably clinical, right? And depending on the different diagnosis of anxiety or depression, whatever, all these different durations for sure. But notice the timeline, how long is this happening, right? And then is this atypical? Are they acting in a way that's not really who they are normally? So now we'll kind of jump into this next part, our response. All of this junk that you're telling us about, Jeremy, how do I use this? What do I do with this stuff, right? So I'll say the biblical perspective here, jumping into that second part that we mentioned all the way up top, that this season, if I have an adolescent with anxiety and depression, this season is an opportunity for us to deepen our relationship, okay? One thing I like to say is, you can say that you have unconditional love for your kid, but if you never get into a hard spot with your kid, then you aren't really proving if you have unconditional love for your kid, right? But if my kid is acting like a turd, well, now it's going to be exposed. Do I have unconditional love, or do I only love you when you're not a turd? Because if you're a turd, I don't love you anymore. Kind of dynamic, right? And it's the same thing with depression, with anxiety. When these difficult things pop up for us, what can happen is we say, nope, you don't get me, relationship with me, go to your room, be a better person. Once you figure out how to be a better person, then we can have some relationship together, right? Or if we see depression, anxiety as an opportunity, then we know in this difficult time, it's going to be hard for me. But on the other side of this experience and these experiences, because there will be multiple, my adolescent will know how much I truly care, and we will build a deeper, more intimate relationship, which, by the way, will pay off when they become an adult, when they start having their own kids, when they start struggling with their jobs, when they bop, 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 because they'll know this is a person I trust, and I can come to them with some real questions, some hard stuff. If I'm really questioning whether I should stay in my marriage or not, I remember how my parent dealt with me. And I will be able to give them that question and we'll be able to hold that question together. Whereas if I understand my parents' love is conditional, I remember how they treated me when I wasn't a good kid because I was depressed or whatever it may be, then I'll keep that stuff to myself, okay? So this type of stuff, even though it's difficult, is an opportunity for us to grow so deeply and so grow our intimacy and our relationship together, okay? And then also it helps us to not see it as just a problem. Hey, this is just something I need to fix. Part of the dynamic is realizing, no, this is part of the ride, and so I'm going to engage it, not just try and get rid of it as quick as possible. And then there's also it's supposed to be three, but anyways, opportunity for parents' growth. Obvious, or maybe not obviously, I'll just say, for me as a parent, part of what I learned, actually I'll say it, when I was a single man, I thought I was pretty patient, okay? Partially because I was a super patient guy. When I got married, I realized, dude, I didn't even know what patience was. I thought I was patient. Man, I am not very patient. But then I started to get a hold of it. Now I'm patient, Now I've arrived. Now I'm patient. And then we had our daughter, and I was like, dude, I didn't even know what patience was, right? This little human being is driving me nuts. Part of the dynamic is when these heavy things come into our lives, it exposes things inside of us, right? And these are opportunities for God's grace, by the way. Just like I'm trying to be this space for intimacy and closeness with my child, when my child is sad, irritable, anxious, yada, 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 and it's exposing my impatience, exposing my lack of joy, exposing all these things that are not God-like, well, God is willing to enter that picture and give us grace and say, yeah, I know, I already knew that about you. Let's do this together. And now I can interact with God, feel His grace, and push forward. And okay, God, I don't want to be this way. I want to be different than this, right? And so now I can, through my child's mental health problem, I can interact and become an even healthier person myself through all of it, okay? Critical perspective. Again, it's important to, or the second part of it is important to interact with all these different areas of our children, okay, of our adolescents. And I'll just skip on here. So the four areas, there's the body, there's our thoughts and emotions, which I would say is like our psychology. There's our relationships with others. And then there is the spiritual reality, or our relationship with God, so to speak. Okay. So these four different areas. This is what we're going to kind of talk about here in the response. We're going to be talking about the body here for a little bit. So what do I do as a parent? My child is anxious or depressed. What do I do? Well, let's interact with these four different areas. What does it look like to interact with the body as they're feeling anxious? Okay, like broad strokes. There's so much we could talk about in these things, and we're already out of time. But I'll make it quick. Okay, but super rich at the same time. So the body. So if I notice my adolescent is anxious, depressed, one thing to do is talk with the pediatrician. Okay. Because if it's living inside the body, the pediatrician is able to kind of expose that, right? Sometimes depression symptoms can really be thyroid issues, okay? So now I'm feeling lethargic, etc. Partially not because, because my thyroid is messed up. Another part of it is vitamins. If I'm lacking vitamin D, which is, we definitely are as a culture, but lacking vitamin D, lacking vitamin B, yada, yada, yada. If I go to my pediatrician and say, hey, I'm noticing this irritability, I'm noticing this anxiety, I'm noticing blah, 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 the pediatrician can kind of do an assessment, maybe do some blood work or whatever it may be, bring back the blood work, and either tell you, yeah, I'm not seeing body stuff, or can tell you, wow, man, some of these levels are out of whack. Let's kind of get some of these things in order and see how that impacts your child, okay? The second one is a psychiatrist, especially if it's in crisis phase. You can go to a psychiatrist and say, these are the things I'm seeing. Psychiatrist might say, you know what, let's use some medication to try and lift the mood, give your adolescent some ability to be able to deal with life. And as they deal with life, potentially that some of that stuff will go away. They'll learn some coping mechanisms and then they won't need a medication, or maybe it'll be a lifelong thing, I don't know. But that's another professional you can go to and talk to about the body, the mind in particular. A few other things, diet, which is huge in adolescence. I don't know if you guys did this, but when I was an adolescent, and then with most of the adolescents I talk with, I do tons of like burritos and candy and stuff like that, which surprisingly doesn't really do good for our body. It's a horrible fact, but it's a fact nonetheless. So if you notice, hey, my adolescent is really struggling with irritability, all these different symptoms, maybe take a look at the diet. Okay, what can we do differently with the diet? Okay, potentially going to be a big battle if they don't care. Instituting diet stuff is going to be pretty hard, but if they're in a space of like, yeah, I don't like this and I want to be different, potentially they'll say, oh, awesome, yeah, let's try some more leafy greens, etc., etc. Two more, sleep, which is huge, and then exercise is also linked to sleep. But anyways, sleep is huge. First of all, because naturally, adolescence, your is it circadian rhythm? Is that the word, circadian rhythm? Okay, that changes. Your sleep rhythm changes, okay? So if say your child was going to bed at 9 o'clock, right, and all of a sudden they become a teenager, naturally that is going to push 2 hours farther, okay? So this, in general. So this child becomes an adolescent, and now instead of going to bed at 9 o'clock, they go to bed at 11 o'clock naturally, okay? That's what their body's telling them. Hey, you're not tired, stay up. And then, so then they go to bed at 11. I mean, please God, let them go to bed at 11. And then they wake up at 7 in the morning for school or whatever it may be, right? Well, that's only 8 hours of sleep, and supposedly they're supposed to get 9 to 9.5 hours sleep. Wow, they're already sleep deprived. And that's if they're going to bed at 11, which some aren't doing that. So as you kind of push into the sleep dynamic with your student, you can kind of notice, oh man, they're super sleep deprived. Part of what I'm seeing here, it's very difficult to keep control of negative thoughts, very difficult to keep control of your mood when you haven't been sleeping well, okay? Your body's out of whack, it's very difficult. And then alongside this, exercise. If you're not exercising, that impacts your sleep. It's hard for you to sleep. Well, now you have two problems. Now your body's all out of whack in terms of just the exercise dynamic and your health, but then now you're also not sleeping, so now you got, you know, this compounded thing. So all of these things potentially interact with in terms of the body. Relationships. One thing I want to emphasize, so relationships and thoughts, emotions are don't worry about that one. What I do want to say is be careful, because our own fear as parent can really cause us to make all relationship dynamics about fixing, okay? So every time I'm interacting with my son or daughter, I'm asking questions about, hey, how's your anxiety doing? Hey, how are you doing with your friends? How are you doing? How are you feeling? Blah, blah, blah. And now every time I interact with my child, they're like, dude, man, hello, I'm a person too, or whatever it may be, right? So part of the dynamic with relationship is trying to create a sense of togetherness, okay? As much as I'm wanting to use the little bit of time I'm getting with my adolescent to fix them, to try and get rid of some of these things, at the same time, try really hard to make more space for the sense of togetherness, okay? So we definitely are trying to fix. There are definitely things, especially if it's in a crisis situation, we've got to show up and try and fix and get them to a space of at least a balance. But at the same time, trying to create spaces where we feel together, they feel connected, they feel like a valued, just a human being, okay, not just a problem. And some of the ways, you know, let's go for a walk, let's go bowling, let's go color me mine, let's just do some stuff that we're just together, we're just being people together kind of thing, okay? Some of the research shows that serving, especially for depression in particular, serving is such a rich thing for our brains and our moods and whatever it may be. It really changes our perspective. I mean, I'm not sure how many of you guys have done missions trips, but you know how you go to a mission trip and you're like, dude, I thought my neighborhood was horrible. Oh man, I thought it was such a bummer that I only get to have Starbucks 3 times a week. And now I see these people in Mexico or whatever, and I'm like, wow, I'm so thankful for what I have, right? So serving others, feeding the homeless as a family, whatever it may be, can be so rich, especially for depressed individuals. It changes their perspective, and then also gives them a sense of, wow, it feels so good to care for other people, okay? One thing is our family as a model of emotions and expectations around things. This is the hard part as a parent, okay? The way I'm interacting with all of my kids, the kid who's struggling with mental health issues or not, tells everyone in the family what's safe and what's unsafe, right? In some sense, if you show emotions here, is it safe to show emotions here? Is it safe to only show certain emotions here? Another thing is, if you achieve, if you do well, then you're accepted here. If you don't achieve, then you're not accepted here. That exacerbates depression, anxiety, when you get the sense that not only do I feel bad about myself that I'm not doing good in my classes or not doing as well as I want to be, but I also know that mom and dad are going to disconnect from me because I didn't do good on my tests or whatever it may be, right? That exacerbates this feeling of anxiety. Now I'm even more afraid of interacting with tests or whatever it may be, or I'm afraid of interacting with my parents at all. Now I pull away from them, okay? So being very aware that how do I model when my adolescent maybe isn't doing as well as they could be on certain things? Am I giving them space to talk about their emotions? Am I downloading my disappointment, my anger, my whatever may be completely onto them? Or am I doing it in a balanced way that says, hey, how do we talk about this in ways that affirms you, that gives you kind of I'll unpack this in just a second. Let me go to this next one. And then also create these conversations that kind of helps them understand. In general, you want to create conversations so they understand what's going on for themselves, not just you're telling them all the time, hey, I went to this anxiety thing and this is what it is. Here's what you know now. This is how you are and now I've got all the information for you. You want to give them space to kind of unpack themselves, right? One big one is when you're interacting with them, if they're disconnecting from people, then try hard to create a conversation where they can see that for themselves. Isn't that interesting? You know, I remember last year, you and Luke, didn't you guys used to go to Starbucks all the time or something? Oh yeah, for sure. What's going on? Oh, I don't know. I guess I've just been feeling really funky. Oh man, what's that like for you? That you haven't been hanging out with him as much. How's that feel for you? And give him or her space to kind of talk about, oh yeah, I guess I have been withdrawing. When I feel bad, when I feel angry, whatever, I don't really interact with people. thoughts and emotions, as an individual, try and encourage for them as an individual, not in our relationship, but for them as an individual, encourage things like journaling, encourage things like mental health apps, which there are a billion of those, but mental health apps will kind of help them to be able to log into this thing by themselves and kind of see their own journey. Oh man, this past couple of days, I've been really mad this past couple of days. I'm starting to see this pattern or whatever it may be. So as an individual, you can give them some of those resources around their thoughts and emotions. And then thoughts and emotions within relationship, within us. Ask questions about how frequent it is. So it seems like you're pretty irritated. Does that happen a lot for you? Or is it just every once in a while? Like once a week, twice a week, once a month? What's help them to kind of be able to see how often is this happening for me? And then create conversations. And I love Andy Richter said when he went to college, I don't know his background, but he made it sound like he didn't have a strong family dynamic. But when he went to college, he said therapy was helpful in college because, and this to me enlivens me because it kind of highlights sometimes how easy it can be. Helpful in college because it was a place where I could organize my thoughts and feelings. It's like I went to this place all week long. I'm running. I'm doing homework. I'm blah, 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 blah. And then I sit down with this therapist, and it's this 45 minutes of the therapist saying, hey, man, how was your week? And me going, oh, man, it was okay. Oh, really? Why okay? Well, I had a test. Oh, really? What was the test like? Oh, man, I got really freaked out. Really? Freaked out? What do you mean by it? Well, I guess not freaked out, but it's kind of scary. Scary. And slowly but surely, they just have space to be able to get everything that's inside them they're not even focusing on out in the open. And you as a parent can create that dynamic for them when you say, hey, man, how's your week? If they talk to you, obviously, adolescents can be a pretty rough time in terms of conversations. But if they do talk to you, it can be as simple in some sense about just creating space for them to get everything out. And then they're able to make observations about, oh, wow, that's how I operate. I didn't realize that. That's how I'm constantly interacting with school or with my friends or whatever, with those fears or with those sadnesses or whatever it may be. There's some more stuff about conversations. I just want to highlight a handful of these. As a therapist, I'm doing two things. I'm listening to content. Oh man, I broke up with my boyfriend. Oh man, I had a test this week. Oh man, my parents and I fought. All of these content things. What happened in your week content-wise, right? But as I'm listening to content, I'm hearing process, okay? Really? How'd you feel during those times? What'd you think during those times? And what's going to be some things that become exposed from like a cognitive behavioral standpoint are these types of processes, okay? When I interact with my world and with the environment, stresses or whatever it may be, I tend to catastrophize. As I'm talking with my therapist, I start realizing, wow, as I'm talking about tests, or as I'm talking about blah, 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 or maybe I make the observation, I kind of catastrophize. I exaggerate the harmful effects, right? Oh, man, I went to this test. Oh, man, I probably got a D, and I bet you if I got a D, I'm never going to get through this whole class. I tend to really blow it up. For some reason, I exaggerate, I catastrophize, right? Again, this is content underneath all the information. Personalizing, I see myself as the cause of the disappointments, all or nothing, or I call it A or F. I'm either perfect or I'm a failure. Overgeneralizing, one disappointment, it's kind of like catastrophizing a little bit, is an inescapable pattern. Man, if I fail this test, then I'm always going to fail tests. If I don't get in this accepted by this college, then I'm never going to get accepted by colleges. And then the last one is filtering, focusing on negative aspects of an experience or ignoring the positive. And here, I just want to encourage us as parents, okay? I'll just give you this example. My daughter's 5, okay? One of the things I'm trying to teach her, my wife and I are trying to teach her, is to clean up after yourself. You know, once we get done with food, can you just pick up your plate and put it in the sink, okay? In that time, there are times when my daughter, it's usually my son, but anyways, my daughter will pick up the plate and then all of a sudden she bumps it on the table or whatever it may be, and food goes flying, right? Now I got bits and pieces of broccoli or whatever on the floor, right? In that space, I can model to her filtering. Two things happen at the same time. Positive and negative things happen at the same time. My daughter was being responsible. Do I tell her that? Do I underline that? Or do I go straight to the, come on, Maya! Duh! Would you just pick it up, sweetheart? You gotta put it. Do I just focus on one or the other? Or do I give her both? Because if I'm able to give her both, then she's able to start filtering in her own life. I make mistakes, but I'm not a bad person all the time, right? I don't have to just be one or the other. I don't have to always filter, always be looking for negative things in my life. I can actually see both of them, okay? So that's kind of the content underneath the conversations that we have with our kids. Spiritual, and we're way over, but is in general, in your home, do you guys have a sense, and maybe this is just your walk, do you have a sense that your relationship with God is grace-filled? And if it is, you have a lightness in your dynamic with God. You can go to God with your problems. You can go to God with your mistakes. You can tell Him, hey, I was lusting. You can tell God, hey, God, I really wanted to steal from my company. You can give God the imperfect things inside of you because you sense His grace is there. And you sense that He's going to say, man, thanks for confessing that. Let's try again. Let's keep going. You'll sense that lightness. Or do you have a sense in your own walk with God that that there's going to be guilt, weighty guilt. Anytime you mess up, God's going to be like, oh, man, are you serious? Because I died for you. You know I died for you, right? You should get this one right. You know what I'm saying? If you have that sense, you'll probably parent from that sense. You know what I'm saying? Your kids will get the sense, not of grace, if there's no grace, or of grace, if there is grace. Okay? So part of the dynamic is watching for your kids. Maybe it's you, maybe it's they've heard this in scripture or whatever it may be. Get a sense. How do they experience grace in their life? When they do mess up on a test, do they understand that, hey, yeah, God sees it. He wants you to confess if you did something wrong. And at the same time, keep going. Here we go. Keep going. Or do they get that heavy sense of guilt? Man, I'm a mess up. No one can accept me type dynamic. So spiritually, keep your eyes open for that. What's their dynamic with God like? Do they feel a lightness or do they feel this heavy guilt? And then pray. Pray together. Or I'll say pray separate. Obviously, as parents, we're just praying, God, please put good people in their life. Please get good information. Help them with their thoughts. Help them with their heart. Help them as they're growing, et cetera, et cetera. But then also together. Sometimes if your kid is talking with you and just like, man, I really botched that test. Man, so-and-so broke up with me. As you have these conversations, sometime through it, maybe push pause and say, you know what? You want to pray together about that for a little bit and just talk with God and create this space where we're interacting with the spiritual part of who they are. And then potentially give them some books to kind of read through about God, prodigal God or different books that kind of highlight some of these dynamics. So there are a bunch of resources. Again, we'll leave the PowerPoint here so you guys can check out the different resources. But we'll take a break or you want to just go straight to...
I'll just go right into it.
Okay, go right into it. And so I'll try and remember to repeat the questions as we go forward. But all that to say, a lot of stuff there, most of it wrong. But anything in here that you have questions about, feel free to speak up and ask me, and I'll try hard to interact. Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm realizing like the kids that are this age, like even 18, they never had like a world before 9/11. They had never had a world before terrorism and all that.
Oh, yeah.
So do you see that as like making them to be more depressed? Because it seems like so many kids are depressed and anxious these days, way more than when I was... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. I think there are a few factors. I think one of it's a little more acceptable to be depressed and anxious, so they can bring it out there. But second, yeah, totally, their environment. 9/11, but then even more recently, I think for a lot of adolescents, is school shootings, that sense of, man, there's not a lot of safety in this world, right? And then on top of it, we have a loud political situation. And for them, some of the adolescents I see, getting the sense that, oh, no one's really paying attention to me, so it's... I kind of have to fight for myself. I'm not living in a system that's going to take care of me. I'm living in a system that's fighting in and amongst itself, and so I'm going to have to take care of myself. Some people feel a sense of like, oh, power, then I'm going to make my vote count or whatever it may be. But yeah, a lot of students have this sense of, man, it's not a safe world out there. Good question. Any other questions? That's pretty good. That was pretty good. So I would imagine there's no questions, but... any other thoughts or concerns? Yeah.
So I was wondering, like, depression can be brought on by environment, correct?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
So what if you have like a kid or a mentee or someone that you're pouring into, and they're kind of like in a situation where they can't really escape from the kind of the environment that's kind of creating like this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the question being, hey, I'm interacting with an individual whose depression is brought on by environment, but I can't really relieve the environment. What do I do? That's a great question. I'll say, in general, that's everyone's reality, okay? To some degree, or to more major degrees or lesser degrees, but we all, this side of heaven, that's our reality, okay? We all live in a broken world. And even the people I love are going to let me down, okay? Even my wife, who loves me very much, she's going to let me down. Even though I love my wife, I'm going to let her down. So in some sense, we are all in environments where it's not going to always go well for us, okay? So part of the dynamic, the reason why I bring that up, part of the dynamic is realizing that my life has to be connected with the Father, okay? I need to make sure that I'm connected with God, knowing that this side of heaven, it's always going to be pretty broken at times. Now, I'm not saying it's always been broken at times, okay? So part of this dynamic is highlighting for the mentee, man, I'm heartbroken with you, right? And we can talk about times where, like, Christ is in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he tells his three closest guys, come with me and pray, and they let him down. That was the dynamic so often for Christ, that he needed, but he was being let down, right? And so for us, for this mentee in particular, how do we lean into God? When things are broken, how do we lean into God? How do we find his peace and his for-us-ness inside of these situations? Okay, that's one thing. The second thing is, and I don't know the specifics of the environment, right? If it's a family dynamic, obviously he's going to be going back to that dynamic. Certainly if it's traumatic space, obviously call DCFS or something like that if it's trauma. But if it's a family dynamic, try hard to create some space outside of the family. Hey man, let's go get some coffee, whatever it may be, or texting, hey man, how you doing? So even when he or she is at home, they can kind of be like, oh man, what a rough night. And then you can say, God, and just give them space to kind of unpack in the moment what's happening for them in the environment. I don't know too much more without knowing the specific environment, but some of those things to try and enter the environment and realize, hey man, I get it, it's heavy. Then how do we interact with the heaviness? Because the answer, I guess what I'm trying to say, the answer is not always get out of the environment. In fact, most of the time it's not, let's just get out of the environment. You know, that's kind of what the monks did in early Christianity. This place is horrible. Let's get out in the wilderness, and then it's just us and God type dynamic. I don't necessarily think that's who God wants us to be all the time. He wants to be in the environment, connected with him, connect with those who love him, and pushing against the environment kind of thing. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think that sufficiently, but if there's more questions, feel free. Yeah, right here, and then we'll go here. Go ahead.
So with some of this information, what the conversation, because like I think a lot of us learn some stuff like, ooh, when my son failed his test, how did I deal with that?
Mm-hmm.
You kind of deserve that. How do we kind of take what we learned here to kind of open that door up to kind of not have that positive negative?
Mm-hmm.
Do you get positive, you do well, you get negative. How do we kind of take this and kind of start that conversation? Say, hey, learn this, and now we want to work on it as parents.
Definitely. Yeah, great question. So the question being, hey, so I've learned something about in terms of the way I interact with my adolescent, trying to be a little more nuanced in the way that I approach them when they're making mistakes or whatever it may be. How do I start integrating that into my life? How do I start being a voice that's interacting with their weaknesses, but in a way that also says, I see your strengths kind of dynamic. Part of it's going to be awareness. So now I know something, am I going to keep it? So now next time I interact with my son or daughter, trying to manifest that in my own mind, so to speak. So now I'm interacting with my kid, and I always step left, but now I remember, okay, I got to start stepping right. Well, first, I got to remember to step right. You know what I'm saying? So part of the dynamic is trying to keep that internally. Okay. Next time I interact with my kid, I want to step right, okay? And I say that because that's a big deal. It's not simple. If I've been writing with my right hand my whole life, it's not simple to start writing with my left hand like that. I got to give myself some grace to say, I want to be different, but it's not natural for me, okay? Maybe it wasn't what I learned, whatever it may be, right? The second thing is you just start making mistakes, right? So I reach out to him, hey, man, oh, man, a D. Goodness gracious, another D? Like, the night before you weren't studying, yada, yada, yada. And then I leave the situation, all of a sudden I'm like, that's right, there's this whole thing. Feel free to go back, okay? I'm experimenting here. Go back. Hey, bud, you know what? I just want to tell you, I realized the other day I was listening to this thing, and you know what I want to tell you? I really do appreciate that, whatever it may be. If it's something, hopefully in this situation, I really do appreciate that you tried. I know you did study, and I love seeing you studying, and I want to keep seeing you grow in that, or whatever it may be. Come back after the fact until slowly but surely you're doing it in the moment kind of dynamic. And then if you have a good dynamic with your kid, depending on how on their age, I would initiate to them, hey, you know what? I'm realizing that I don't do this aspect well, and you know, Dad wants to be better at that. So next time we, first of all, do you notice that? Is that something you see? Yes? No? Okay. Second of all, I want to do that better. So next time we have this situation, if you see it, call me on it and tell me. And then in the moment, we'll try and kind of interact with it, depending on age, okay? If they're farther along, they're kind of, you know, older in adolescence, that's going to be a great thing for them to learn as an adult to be, you know, the person who's interacting and relating with people and that. Off the top of my head, I think that's it for right now. Is that good? Okay. Other question?
Anger with the depression.
Mm-hmm.
So I have one that's got PTSD, so it's a whole gamut.
Mm-hmm.
But the anger is difficult to deal with. I can contain it most of the time, but there are times, especially with disappointment, that it's difficult for him to contain it on his own.
Mm.
And I find myself in this dance, and sometimes it's successful, other times it falls apart, and it's a meltdown, full-blown rage, jumping up and down. I mean, it's like, really, you're too big for that. In my mind, I'm thinking,
right.
I'm like, wow, really.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, I let him go through it most of the time, but it's still very overwhelming. It's stressing the little ones in the room out, and it's like, he's not coping right now, and he's got lots of coping skills. Mm. But sometimes, you know, it's like the brain is short-circuiting, and he's like...
Yeah. How old?
Falling apart. 13.
13, okay. Pretty young. So one thing, so the question being anger, how do I interact with anger, especially when it's pretty radical style of anger, right? One thing is empathy. Actually, let me rewind back. So you made a good observation, right? And I don't know how much the PTSD is part of this dynamic, so I'm going to leave that off the table for a second. What you acknowledge, though, you said all of a sudden the brain goes offline, right? When it gets to that space, not a lot you can do to get the brain back online, okay? Right, yeah. At that point, and when it gets to that point, you're going to have to be you're going to have to kind of resign yourself to containing things, okay? So he gets offline and he's throwing things. Well, at that point, now you're going to have to say, okay, right now it's about keeping people safe. Maybe I'll have to pull back and say, hey, bud, we'll talk more in a second, okay? But I'm feeling really scared right now. And try and elicit empathy, okay? That's part of what will bring the mind back on, okay? Hey, bud, you're jumping down up and down right now. I'm getting a little afraid for the kids. And I'm not saying you're trying to jab him with stuff like, see how bad you're being, you're making the kids scared. I'm saying really eliciting empathy, and that kind of brings the brain back on to say, hey, bud, I'm feeling really scared. We're going to talk more about this later on, okay? The second piece is before he gets offline, interacting with him empathetically. So he starts yelling at you, you always do this, or whatever it may be. Try hard to pivot to, instead of defense, self-defense. What? No, I don't always say that. No, last time you... Instead of pivoting to self-defense, pivot to something more empathetic. Wow, man. So does that make you feel frustrated when you get the sense I'm always doing that? And give space to let him put himself out. Because if he gets the sense that he's being heard and validated, potentially, he doesn't have to start swinging. He'll say, oh, so I don't have to defend myself? You're kind of listening to what I'm... Yeah, I do feel like you always don't listen. Okay, I always don't listen. Most of the time you don't listen. Okay, so most of the time. Okay, so what would you like me to do differently? I'm trying to validate his perspective, give him a sense so that he can start coming down emotionally. Okay, got you, buddy. Man, I really appreciate you sharing all that stuff for sure. And then, hey, bud, this is what I kind of need. and then just kind of start talking about those type of things. Now, we're talking about a longer conversation. It's not going to be kind of in and out necessarily. It's going to be a longer conversation. But again, trying to elicit empathy and hopefully try to help them not have to feel like they have to defend themselves. You're not listening because part of the dynamic is, and this is married couples for sure, I get the sense my spouse isn't listening to me, so now I'm going to ramp it up. Because I really need to, I got to pull your face in and get you to look at me to get you to understand what's happening. But you're not, you're just defending yourself. So I got to try harder or I just got to withdraw altogether, right? So that's part of the dynamic with the kid is they get the sense you're not listening. You don't understand me. And so now I got to get louder. Now, until finally I just melt. Just forget it. I'm out of here or whatever it may be. So trying to elicit that empathy first as kind of initial steps. Any other questions? I hear music going on here, but any other questions? Yeah. Kind of.
Like, I think so many of us haven't grown up with that.
Yeah.
Our parents didn't talk to us in that sort of, they just told us.
Right. I'm the adult, I'm the authority, you're the one who follows the rules. We don't have to have a conversation, you just do what I want. Yeah, so the question being, what are the skills? Is that technically active listening? Are there other skills to develop as a parent?
So we could look into that.
Yeah. Yeah, a good book is called Angry PO'd Kids. Just kidding. That's not that. That's not that. How to interact with angry PO'd kids. No, couple, I don't have specifically about anger. That would be a good question. And if you want, you can grab my business card and I can ask some of my colleagues. But I will say in terms of relational dynamics, one is called How We Love Our Kids. And this is by, the last name is Yerkovich, Y-E-R-K, Yerk, O-V-I-C-H, I think, Yerkovich, Yerkovich with a Y. Again, you can grab my card and I can email it to you. But How We Love Our Kids. And that one's kind of talking about what gets elicited in me when we have conversations, what starts coming up inside me, and then what starts coming up inside them, and then how do I, as I start to understand that, then how do I pivot out of what's going on inside me? And it's always important, as I see, it's always important to remember there are two needs happening at the same time. There's their needs, there's my needs, right? It's okay for me to have needs. It's okay for them to have needs. You know, we're just trying to figure out how to speak about our needs, right?
Same ones that we had when
we were kids. Yeah. Definitely, man. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so how do I show up exactly with those kind of primary needs and when it gets elicited, all the stuff. But anyways, that's a good book. Off the top of my head, I don't know any others. There are plenty of books about parenting for sure, but in terms of like that dynamic, that type of listening. Any other, you want to do more questions or you want to push pause? Push pause? Okay. All right, gotcha. Yeah, for sure. Definitely.